Blog Talk Radio.
Yes, yes, yes. People of the world, welcome to Season 6 of GD's A Touch of Grace. Today is May 12, 2015, and the time is 3 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. That was a little snippet of phenomenal jazz man Boney James' Future Soul. Love that one. It's another beautiful day here in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I am pleased to announce that today's guest will be Marcus Patrick. He was born in Bath, England. His father was English, Irish, and French. His mother, Jamaican, Cuban, and Cherokee. His impressive entertainment resume includes roles in such films as Dirty Laundry, Love, and the Other Four-Letter Words, as well as appearances on evening and daytime television on shows such as All My Children, CSI, and the Damon Wayans and Tisha Campbell show, My Wife and Kids. Despite a sometimes troubled childhood, he excelled in piano, voice, gymnastics, and swimming. And he is a dynamic fitness fanatic with skills in Taekwondo, and he even became a junior and men's heavyweight champion. At age 17, he auditioned with Simon Cowell of American Idol fame, and he toured with a boy band until around the age of 20. When he went solo, Cowell acted as his agent and manager. Today, he is still performing. He is a personal trainer, a practicing vegan, and now a father, with the recent birth of a son. Pretty amazing, right? Before I bring him on, here's a little GD perspective. We create magic every day in how we love and in who we love. We are these amazing entities filled with life and passion. And from the moment we are born, we are poised to be incredible. And now, Marcus Patrick. Hey, Marcus, how you doing, man? What's happening?
How are you, Arthur?
You know what? I'm doing pretty good. Yeah, I can hear you very well. Can you hear me?
Yes. Thank you.
All right, all right.
I was just sitting there listening to you introduce me. I was thinking, wow, did I really do all of that? You've done
your
homework.
Yes, you did, my friend. I have to tell you right now, I'm so excited to have you on the show. I've been a fan of yours for years. I think the first time I saw you, it was on the My Wife and Kids with Tisha Campbell and Damon Wayans. I just thought it was incredible. But I've actually been following your career for quite some time. So this show is really all about you. We're going to talk a little bit about your upbringing and what you've been through and spirituality. So the very first part of the show, and yeah, it's going to be good. So in the intro, I mentioned that your childhood was a bit troubled. Can you take us back in time and share as much as you'd like with us about the early years of your life?
Sure, no problem. Let's start when I was maybe at the age of five, you know, first memories of deep consciousness coming into my being. Living in England, being a mixed-race child, light-skinned but with an afro, and living in a a complex that was probably middle class, I would say. It was a middle class environment. You would have thought I would have been safe, but because of the multiracial tension, it was at times very dangerous for me because there were skinheads that would sort of chase us down when I was little. I remember one time being in a park with my sister, and some skinheads came riding their BMX bikes, and they rode into the park, and there was quite a few of them, and they were older than us. And the first thing they said is, look, there's some blackies. And blackies in England is kind of the same term, slur, derogatory term that you would hear over here, like nigger. So immediately chills went through my system at five, like, oh, my God, we're about to get, you know, hurt. Because you can sense that when people have bad intentions, even if you're five, you already know you're in danger. But thank God nothing happened. Point is, it was already beginning to dawn on me that I was not a regular child because I didn't really fit in the black community. When my mom would take me to the black community where it was darker-skinned children, I would stand out as an odd one and sometimes be teased or bullied a little bit. And when I was in the white community, I was always looked at as a black child to the whites, and they would call me a gollywog or a jungle boy or Tarzan, you boy, those kind of slurs, rubber lips. So I actually suffered quite a lot of teasing and a lot of sort of bullying when I was young. So that being said, with the turbulence going on at home because my mom and dad were having a breakdown of relations, it was quite stressful for a youngster. And I remember one time running out into the meadows because Bath is a very very rich green valley village type of town. And I remember just thinking, God, why don't you just open up the ground and take me? Because I really don't understand what I'm doing here. You know. And I remember having a sort of prayer because I was always taken to church by my mom. And it was very weird because my dad was an atheist. My mom was a devout Christian. My dad being very logical and karate teaching and ethical and kind and supportive, and then my mom being Christian but at the same time having some sort of quirks that weren't necessarily ideal. I was just quite confused by the whole thing. I was like, well, how are you raising me, or what is this path? It was like I was just in the middle of two completely conflicting theories and trying to figure out why to some degree they were together and what I was supposed to believe. So that all had a profound impact on me when I was just 5-6 years old. And that's when I started to really, I started to have to spend a lot of time alone as a 5 or 6 year old, because I would go and knock on the white children's door to play. And distinct memory of one of my childhood best friends that I've known since I was 2, his grandmother, I was like, is Steve in there, please? And his grandmother said, Stephen, there's a gollywog at the door for you. And I was
Oh my God.
Yeah, I was just, I don't know, I just remember the feeling. I was just like, I don't know, the blood just left my body.
I just thought
this sweet old lady that looked very sweet, that I immediately thought, well, she's a nice old lady, you know, and she's his grandmother. I mean, I would have assumed she would have known better than to do that to me, but evidently she didn't, you know. I mean, it was like I was an old soul already thinking, well, that's not very good. You're in your 80s and you're teasing me as if you're 5, you know. So, I mean, I was having these profound experiences very young. And so sometimes the white kids wouldn't play with me. And the black neighborhood was far, farther away because we were lucky that my father being white, I guess, put us in the white neighborhood, even though we were the one or the two semi-black families on that neighborhood block. But it was kind of like I was in jeopardy no matter where I was. And when I went out in that meadow, I said, God, you know, either you're going to have to help me here because I'm just seeming to feel alone. There's no peace in the house because my mom and dad are fighting. If I try to play with my white friends, I'm getting called a gollywog or I'm just like the least popular. And And then there was the danger of the skinheads that you always had to worry about. So I ended up just sort of like climbing trees. Honestly, I became like a chimpanzee. I could climb trees that were literally like 100 foot high. And
wow.
Because, yeah, it's an insane thing. If you go outside and you look at one of the highest trees that you can imagine in your local neighborhood, I would climb that, go all the way to the top, and literally kind of risk death swinging from branch to branch, just the same way you'd see a monkey. And it's because, uh-huh, I guess the instincts that I was having was I stayed out. Like, my parents couldn't find me until it was dark. And I remember my mother would come and scream, "Patrick, Patrick," because I was out at night in those trees. So I started off kind of weird. You know what I mean? Like,
wow,
okay. The whole part of my youth was very different. And it sort of catapulted me into this conversation with God very young and being in nature. And I started to learn how to make fire and start making dens and bases out in the wood, meaning I was like trying to make my own homes out there, you know. My father would always have an allotment, and he would have a sack of potatoes that were in the garden shed. So I would go and grab those sack of potatoes and run off down to the forest woods. We call it down the bank because it was like a slope and it was in the forest. And then I would make a fire, and then I could cook my own potatoes in the fire by just wrapping them with aluminum foil and throwing that in the fire. And then I was just, you know, eating those potatoes and staying out all day because I didn't want to be around the toxicity of my home environment. And a couple of friends then started thinking I was cool for being able to do that. So then I did actually have a couple of white friends that started to, like, join in with me and, you know, hang out down the bank. And we started getting knives and thinking we were Rambo and all that. But this is what started me off on a sort of different journey to most. And then it kind of got weirder when at 9, my mother and father had a big argument, and it kind of became somewhat violent right in front of me. And then my mom and dad ended up, like, getting into this argument where one was pulling me with one arm, because I ran down and tried to break him up, like, crying. And as I was trying to break him apart with my hand, I ended up in a tug of war between the two of them. And that was a sort of very weird but poignant moment in my life as a memory, that I'm in a tug of war between my parents,
right,
and crying, and they're angry. And then my dad let go of my hand. My mom pulled me out of the house. And that was the last time I saw my dad for a year, because my mom then, what was called technically kidnapping, she took me to America. I mean, she would just say, "It's not kidnapping, you're my child." But it was like I was taken to America with my younger sister without my dad's knowledge or consent or anything. And we ended up sort of being dragged around from relative to relative, New York, Connecticut, then down to Florida, finally settling. And it was just a very traumatic ordeal to go through when you're 9 years old. And that was another different sort of thing that shaped my consciousness to realize this world is very bizarre, you know, very, very
right.
Dangerous. I'm shocked I'm even alive, honestly, that I'm getting ready to turn 41, because the amount of events I've been through that I really thought there was going to be the end of my life really shocked me. And the only thing I can always put it down to is that God has been, you know, blessing me and watching over me to some degree, because, I mean, I've just been through too many situations where I technically could have or should have perished.
Right. So I have a question. So you say that, so you were had those experiences in Bath, England, and then your mother kind of took you away from all that and moved you into the U.S. So how long did it take for you, because we had our own racism thing going on over here as well, and we still do for that point. How long did it take you to adjust to the culture here? Did you find any difference once you arrived in the United States?
Well, my black family that's on my mother's side, that we're all here in Florida, out in Miami, were very loving, very welcoming, very warm. And I immediately did feel like, oh, wow, this is great. You know, my auntie, my cousins, you know, my black family were very nice, and it made me feel like, oh, this is nice, you know, to have family that makes you feel very warm and loving and doesn't see color. They didn't see me as a white boy. They just saw me as their relative and loved me. And so that was fun. But when I went to school, I immediately realized that there was a segregation between the Cubans, the blacks, the whites, and that the school that I was put into in Dade, in Florida, Miami, was actually sort of like one of the more ghetto schools. Let's just keep it real. The school didn't even have any windows. I mean, it looked like a converted prison. I wouldn't be surprised if it really was a former prison, but then they turned it into a school because there was not a window in sight. So when I went into school each day, I mean, I've never been inside any prison technically other than what that school was like, but the canteen looks like the prison, you know, and the fact that it had no windows and it was just all brick. You know, I'm like, that had to have been a prison that was just formally then turned into a school. That school was pretty horrific. And to me, the violence began when they heard my British accent. And, you know, I remember getting kind of bullied and picked on. One time I got choked out cold. Like, you know, how you see UFC guys, they're getting choked out to their, like, limp. I got choked limp and then just thrown into the grass. And I remember as my life force faded from the grip around my neck, I remember just thinking, okay, I'm dead, you know, this is it. You know, I don't understand why I'm being choked to death, but this sucks. It's basically what I was thinking, like, this is terrible.
There's something I have to ask you. Oh, my God, I'm sitting here, I got tears in my eyes because, you know, when I saw you, I see this very handsome guy, very outgoing, very free-spirited. No one would know of the dark times that you had in your life. And, you know, I'm reflecting on when you talked about you were kind of tribal, you know, back over in England when you were out there cooking food and climbing trees and all of these things. And, you know, then you get over here to America and you're being bullied. So now at one time you wanted to be a professional fighter. Can you tell us about that and why you decided to take another path as opposed to going into the fighting realm?
Well, based upon that chokeout, when I woke up in the grass and no one was around, I'd missed the school bus, I had to walk like an hour to get home. And when I got home, my mom went, "What's wrong with your neck?" I was like, "I was strangled." So she then went to the school and she, because it was red, my neck was like just red and swollen. She went to the school and had an argument, but they didn't really take her seriously because they just looked at her as a complainatory black woman, brushed it off. Mm-hmm. If your son was really strangled, he'd be dead. So just brush it off and get on with your life. So I was kind of, at that point, I was like, oh my God, I'm so close to being dead. I don't even understand. There's no safety. I mean, and also my mother being a single parent at that time, we were in a very ghetto community, a very impoverished community. You know, 9 to 10 years old, I understood what ghetto was like. You know, even the apartment was filled with roaches, and outside it was like thugs and criminals and drug dealers, and I was just like, I mean, it was just dangerous just going in and out of the apartment complex. So I've had a very... I understand the ghetto. I understand the rough life. So it's like when people see me and they think, well, are you black or are you white? I'm like, look, man, I'm just me. And I know what it's like to live breadline. I know what it's like to have one pot of soup that's going to last an entire week, you know. My father then found a way to get a hold of me at my school because the courts asked for my mother to provide the English court with some sort of proof that I'm going to school, that I'm safe and I'm alive. And he was able to then discover where I was at school. And he came and he asked me, did I want to come back and be with him? And I said, yes, absolutely. Because I just found him to be the more caring, responsible parent, quite frankly. And so he's a karate teacher. You know, he's got his flaws too. He has certain cold, calculative ways of living because he's atheist. And whether he calls himself atheist or just non-God believing, he's more of a scientist. He's a master of physics and all of that. So therefore, his way of looking at life is very calculated and constructive. And I enjoyed being under his watch because my mother was, quite frankly, at times losing her temper and breaking broomsticks over my back and hitting me over the head with shoes. And that was quite a constant thing being spoken about in our family. Like, why are you hitting your son over the head with shoes? Why are you breaking broomsticks over his back? You know, this is just not good. You could brain damage your son. You could, you know. And she would get irate, and I know this is, like, not the nicest thing to be sharing, but it's just the truth, and it's a part of our human condition, because I've forgiven her for it, because basically maybe the slave trade taught her parents to do that, and then her parents passed that down, and that's been something that has been in certain Black cultures, especially Jamaican cultures, where ass whippings are very real, you know, and that was the kind of ass whipping I was getting on a regular, because I was the only boy. And so when I finally went back to my father, and my father said, look, do you want to do karate now? And like, when I was five and he was trying to take me to karate, I was like, Dad, this is the most boring stuff on the planet, you know? Like, I have no, I don't want to be punching the air all night, you know, with you. Because he was teaching at the Bath University for 20 years. So he's a very expert at karate. And he loved it because he had also been abused at a certain point when he was young. So it was like he knew that it was important to be strong. And once I'd had that choke out in America and I'd gone back to England, I was actually now completely the opposite. I was obsessed with karate from the age of 10. Like, my dad had taught me about it from the age of 5, but I had been kind of like begrudgingly going along, you know, doing my katas and punching and kicking the air, thinking this is some boring crap that my dad is asking me to do, and but he is my dad, so I guess I'm going to do it. But when I came back from America, I was the complete opposite. I was like, Dad, it's on. Can I have a punch bag? Can I have weights in my bedroom? I threw the bed out of my bedroom window, and my neighbors saw it float out of the top window and started laughing. They were telling me, we thought you were crazy, man. We thought you throwing a bed out the window. And it's because I was making my first dojo. My bedroom, that might have only been the size of anyone's average living room, you know, a fairly small living room, suddenly became a dojo. I was drilling in a wall bracket, had a 6-foot kickback, had the speed bag, had a bench that I found in a skip. We found weights all over the place, bought them from the newspapers for cheap. My friends helped me get it up in there, and I became obsessed. We found a cheap TV and a video VCR. We were playing Van Damme, bodybuilding video we could get our hands on. We were playing it every night, and we were in that room, and I was the head trainer from like 10 years old. We were obsessed. We were obsessed after that because, for me, I had been bullied, and it was like time to say enough. You know, I didn't want to be bullied by my mother anymore because she was physical with me. I didn't want to be bullied by other kids anymore. I was like, it's over. I'm not going to allow myself to be this weakling that gets pushed around anymore. And that was the big shape changer for me that drove me to train like an obsessed madman almost every day. Until I became British heavyweight men champion at 16. So, I mean, that was quite a feat to pull that off because I really was way too young to be in the men's heavyweight division. But I kind of knew how to move like Floyd Mayweather in the sense I hit and moved. But at the same time, with all the weight training I was doing, I could hit so hard at that age that the grown men were literally calling me steroid boy because they were like, what is up with this kid? And I was like, I don't take steroids. Don't you dare offend me. I've been training for years, hard. But some of my friends were like, you should take that as a compliment. You know, you're kicking grown men's asses at 16. But what started to happen was once I got to the age of like 17, I had started to really get so strong that I could damage men to the point I had broken someone's arm, broken a nose.
Oh, my God.
A tooth. Yeah, I'd knocked out a tooth. I'd broken someone's ribs and sent them to a hospital on a gurney. And that particular one started to stick with me because he made such a terrible noise like a wounded animal that it literally like haunted my soul for years after. And even though I was kind of trying to celebrate the victory of taking a man down, my consciousness began to feel terrible about what I had done to him. You know, in the name of competition, I had kicked him with a reverse spinning back kick under his armpit and broke his ribs and it'd gone into his body. The rib, you know, the ribs had collapsed into his organs inside of his body. And
Dana Martin, wow,
yeah,
you had a lot of rage
in you.
Oh,
so
absolutely.
So there was like an epiphany that happened. You crushed this guy's ribs, and you had an epiphany. You say that it stuck with you for a while. So let's talk about Hollywood. Okay, so you realize that you could do damage to another human being, and something clicked in you, changed. How did you get to Hollywood? At what point in time did you start on that path?
It was the day that I was boxing, and I was like, okay, I beat a world kung fu champion, and I was only 17. So I'm like, wow, I beat the guy that everyone thought I couldn't beat. I beat a couple of Goliaths because they were bigger than me, they were stronger than me, and I beat them. And I was just like, I beat them much the same way you see Muhammad Ali beat George Foreman. He kind of rope-a-dope situation and made the best of it with his mind. I was using my mind and whatever physical skills I had to beat these giants that no one, which was people were saying, you're going to get beat by that guy. I'd be like, really? Watch me. And what had happened was I was boxing, and I was like, you know what? I know I could be the heavyweight champion of the world. I just know it. But then I sat in the bathtub one day, and my head, as I went to put more hot water in, because I'm a real fan of baths. I stay in baths for like an hour and just keep heating myself up like it's a sauna. You know what I mean? I've created my own sauna system, so I'm sweating into the bathtub with salts and just keep making it hot. And that's been something that I think has sustained me. But as I went to put the bathtub on more, the hot water on more, my brain just kind of like felt like, I was like, what is that? Like, oh my God, like my body's exhausted from boxing, but you know, my brain shouldn't be exhausted, man. My brain shouldn't feel damaged. And I was like, you know, I can either get out of this now, because people keep telling me you're too pretty to fight, and you know, you don't want to end up like Muhammad Ali with these brain injuries. Or you can continue. And I said, well, what am I going to do? I'm like, well, you're going to have to leave this fight game behind and do what other God-given talents you have, which is to sing and act and all that stuff. So I was like, maybe I can just use it for that. Maybe I can use my fight skills to be a Hollywood star. You know, I'll go and try and be a Van Damme or a Bruce Lee. I mean, I'm clearly the real deal. Like, you know, I'm not – if you watch The Matrix and watch Neo or Keanu Reeves play Kung Fu, if you're a real martial artist, you can tell that he's not. You just can tell that he's an actor who's been put through, you know, 3 months of training, but his body doesn't possess the power required to really throw the punches and kicks. There's no disrespect to him. He did a marvelous job as an actor, and the film was wonderful. But a person who knows how to deliver real blows that could break people, and a person who doesn't, you know, or an actor who's just being paid to do it and trained to do it in the moment. So I knew I could go to Hollywood and do that. But when I got to Hollywood, I was kind of taken on all kinds of different directions, you know, like, oh, you're a great funny comedy guy, or, you know, we need you over here. You got to be African-American. So, you know, I had to learn to have an African-American accent, shave my head, put the whole African-American image on, you know what I mean, so that I could find a way to have a niche, because those producers, those casting directors, those agents, they are always sort of trying to shape and mold you as a product that they're going to sell to the market. And they're looking at you as, okay, you're going to be marketed in this way, so you have to be this. And that was kind of an ordeal at the time, where I was just like, this is weird, but I guess this is part of my job that I have to accept. And then, you know, having really studied acting and done it as passionate as I possibly could, to the point I'd say that the most poignant role I took on was when I played with Rosario Dawson. I played a rapist that, you know, basically raped a guy who had raped her in the movie.
I saw that clip.
Exactly. And
man, I have to tell you right now, that clip was intense, because I've seen you in many different roles, but what did you, I'm just going to ask, I think I know the answer, but what the hell did you channel when you did that? Because you were almost like demonic.
Yeah. I would say that you just hit the nail on the head. In order to play that role, I had to almost allow for demonic energies to come into me at that time. Just like when I was fighting. Like, you can't really be about, like, light and Christ and truth and angelic energy if you're a fighter, or if you're acting in a role where you're a murderer or a rapist. The only way you can really access that is through a sort of demonic, you know, invitation, which I've had to denounce completely and let it go out of my soul and push it out and pray it out. But you have to realize when you invite that in, you know, it's like, for instance, I had to start rolling my tongue and bringing my voice down into a different octave because I became a much different kind of animal guy where everything is about my ego and machismo, you know? It's like I am starting to layer the guy darker and darker. And so I'd order food for a month in that way. I would grab my friends just as practice and act like, you know, I'm going to rape them for fun. And they'd be like, all right, dude, you're getting too into this character. And they would go, you're scaring me. And it was like these things were massive lessons for me in terms of the toxicity of acting versus the fact that you can actually manipulate and use acting to method act a demigod. Because if you look at the role Brad Pitt played in California with a K, he became the dirty hillbilly. He took the crown off of his chipped tooth. He let his hair grow. He didn't shower for a week. And it was reported that he stunk on set horrifically so that the actors would really be perturbed by his presence, you know? Now, that's probably his worst-looking appearance role. And if you flip the script Achilles in Troy, he looked like a glowing demigod, the best he's ever looked, you know, like muscles, glowing hair, moved like a demigod, you know. It was like he personified a god on screen and looked very beautiful and sexy and majestic. And it's like all of that's based upon an idea. It's just the difference of the idea. So if he has an idea to be a dirty hillbilly that's a murderer rapist who stinks, then that's the idea given to him by the script, but look at what the idea did to him in reality. And the same thing with the reality of the idea when he plays the demigod. So you're seeing the same human being with a completely different idea, complete different result. So that's when I started to go, well, you know, I'm really not so concerned with, like, chasing this acting career anymore if it's going to degrade my being. I'd rather use the lessons I've learned from being an actor to upgrade my being rather than allow acting to destroy me and take me down because of the demons that I'm having to get in bed with, so to speak. You know what I'm saying? Like, not literally in bed, but I'm having to allow them in so I can do these roles.
You know what? It's funny that you mentioned that because I get the invoking of different spirits when you become these characters on screen. I remember they were talking about Heath Ledger, and of course his most famous role was the Joker in the Batman series, and I heard that he had to invoke some very dark spirit that, you know, it pretty much ruined him. And I remembered Philip C. Hoffman also.
There you go.
I read where he was on stage, and every day around the same time he would be on stage and have to invoke this certain emotion, it almost crushed him. So is this what changed your mind and wanted you and you wanted to move away from that? Is that what happened to you?
Yeah, I lost the passion for it because I was like, look, either you're going to recognize who I am and give me the role that I am truly playing in life, which is, you know, I am acting as a demigod in life. Therefore, I would be good at playing a demigod on screen because I'm already acting that and preparing that in my life. But if you're going to send me out and every time I go out for a role or I'm up for a role, it's going to degrade my being. And I have to take myself down from the current projected focus to integrate myself into the lower entity area. It's no longer appealing to me anymore because, you know, having had fame or money since you're a young kid and realizing that it can come and it can go. You know, I was famous with Simon Cowell at 17 and couldn't walk the streets without girls screaming and chasing me. And then that sort of dwindled and fizzled away. Then I come to America and I get fame again, whether it's a soap opera, and then it sort of fizzles away. Then I get another film and it comes back up. And then I've got this sort of YouTube type of fame from being a sexy guy or a playgirl guy. So it's like, it's really all superficial nonsense. The reality of it is the most important thing that you are on this planet is an unlimited spirit. But if you are limited by your job, your profession, your label, your color, your creed, or your sexual orientation, Now you have actually limited what God originally intended you to do and be.
Mm-hmm.
And so
right.
anything that's limiting me in that way becomes kind of like an instant enemy to my life. Like, okay, I don't really want that. You know, if you want to pay me correctly to bring something to the people that can inspire the people, like I would love to play a biblical character that had an inspirational story and an arc. I would love to play a superhero, you know, but they tend to cast people who have almost manipulated the system up to the top of the acting realm because, you know, most of the actors you see who play superheroes are actually either doing steroids to get the muscles instantly or whatever. They're not really method acting it from a true place. They're just like, okay, what do we got to do to make me look like this superhero? Okay, let's just jump on some steroids for a month, and then, you know, next month we got to change to be a skinny guy again, you know? So it's an unfortunate thing.
You know, it's funny, too, that you mentioned that, because I know that I saw Anthony Mackie, in which I thought he played a wonderful role in the Winter Soldier with Captain America. I thought that was just incredible. And so being that we're talking about bodies, one thing that I've noticed about you, Marcus, is that when it comes to showing off your body, there's nothing bashful about that. Where does that confidence come? Because, you know, it's not... To me, when I view the pictures, and I know that you did the Playgirl shoot, it doesn't come off as slutty. It almost comes off as being very natural and just, you know, it's like, how could you feel anything is dirty about showing off your body and sexuality? Where does that confidence come from?
Well, honestly, for me, it comes from God. And most people have an issue with that because they think that you should be covered up if you're in some sort of religion. I'm not religious. I'm spiritual. And I've always subscribed to sort of an independent spiritual observation of what God is in a true sense. Meaning, I noticed that there are so many different religious gangs and versions of what God is supposed to be, with that entire gang or religious version trying to sort of shuttle everybody down that particular supermarket aisle of how to worship God. That it's like, well, if God is an independent master of this universe, why do I need to subscribe to aisle one or aisle five? God owns the entire supermarket. So I don't understand why y'all are trying to, like, pretend that you have the blueprint on God. So it's really, everyone is almost free under God. And the religions were designed and invented sort of to collect the money from the people, the gathering, give me your money, let me have you under my church sermon, and we have your money now. Whereas if you look at the ultimate superhero, which is Jesus Christ, and you really study that legend, he was the Sermon on the Mount. And the Sermon on the Mount means he didn't collect money. He went to a mountain, and you came to him for free. If anything, he fed you for free. And if you really look at the original scriptures, he didn't feed people the wine and the fish. It was bread and fish. And it was actually, he went to the trees, and plucked the trees of the food and taught the people, look, your food is in the wild. And everyone ate. And so there's been a perversion based upon money because obviously those fishermen back in the day wanted King James or whoever it was that was manipulating the biblical text to put in, please put fish that Jesus ate because that will help our business. So it's like you can see how the perversions, like there are 200 versions of the King James Bible since 16th century. So 200 different versions of the same Bible, but since the 16th century, that was then already being translated by, you know, and edited by King James back in the day. And King James was not a very good individual, so you really do your research on him, you know. And then you've got the Crusades of Constantine chopping off people's heads and burning down other people's churches, forcing people into Christianity in the first place. And then before that, it was translated from Greek to English. Before that, it was translated from Hebrew to Greek. Before Hebrew, it was Aramaic. It was Arabic or Aramaic. Before it was Aramaic, it was hieratic, which is almost back to Egyptian hieroglyphs, which is where the original tablets come from. Now, if you track the story back in your mind, this all makes sense. Moses was at Egypt with those pyramids that I went in and laid in. And in the pyramids are hieroglyphics. Hieroglyphics are the truth. They are the true Bible. Now, this is where the story gets really interesting. because I pray to God all the time for guides and help. And I went to those pyramids and laid down and said, you know what, God, please let me understand who built these things, because this is not of our society. This technology is way more advanced. If you've ever been to those pyramids or seen them up close, you know that they come from either aliens or human beings as a culture that just existed at a completely different, higher level of consciousness than the one we're currently existing in. So I laid in the pyramid and I said a prayer, please let me understand what's going on here. And, you know, it took me a long time, but here I meet this brother named Nun Amen who can translate the hieroglyphics. He spent his time, you know, where I was spending my time traveling the world, going to Greece and Egypt and trying to find the truth of what Jesus really stood for and why Jesus was so great, why the legend is so great, why there were demigods, why the pharaohs are being hidden as black people that were technically able to do feats way above the current status quo here. So now we've got this brother on the planet named Nun Amen Ra, who is the world record holder, pound for pound, possibly the strongest man on the planet, lifting 3.8 times his own body weight. We're talking he lifts 672 pounds off the ground. And he only weighed 176 pounds because he does it in an Amen protocol, meaning he fasts and he exists and lives like he's a spiritual prayer 24/7. And I mean, I've witnessed him. I've paid this man to consult with this man, and slowly, by respecting his time, and he saw that I was an intelligent, appreciative person of his time, we came to call each other brothers. People these days are not respecting wisdom. They're running around in this YOLO mentality. They've lost all ethic of what used to be the martial art principle of respect your teacher, respect your master. That seems to have just disintegrated in this society. But it's not disintegrated in me. I know the key. You want to know somebody's wisdom, you respect their time, you respect their energy. Like when I was young, you bow to your sensei. You bow to the room. And you put your hand on your heart, and you're not to misuse this power. This power is not to be misused for bullying. You're being taught how to kill, but you're not to be being taught how to kill and be irresponsible with it. You have to be integral. With great power comes great responsibility. So obviously, Nun Amen Ra has, you know, become a person who's really, you know, integral now into my life, because I'm studying that wisdom from the pyramid hieroglyphics. Now, some people will have an issue with all of this because they haven't done the research. They've never left Oklahoma, and they're not going to, you know, resonate with what I'm saying. But I'm not trying to offend anybody here. I'm actually trying to upgrade and help people to understand that the entire system has been flawed. Like, if you think about it, the Egyptian biblical hieroglyphics, they left with Moses and became the Judaic religion. Then when they became Aramaic and Arabic, they left with Muhammad and became the Muslim religion. Then when the Apostle Peter left because Jesus was slaughtered, he ran and became the Vatican, the Catholic Church. And then Christian Crusade was the crusade that started up about 80 years after Jesus had passed and then resurrected himself and then he had ascended away. 80 years after, people just believed in the legend so much that it just kept on growing. And it was only supposed to be like 200 followers of the Christian crusade to begin with, but it kept spreading like wildfire, even though the Romans were trying to chop off any Christian's head. So you've got to realize that originally it all came from those hieroglyphics. Okay? So now you have
I have a question about you. Your spiritual journey is a show all by itself, and I'm definitely going to have you back on because I need to hone up on the spiritual part and aspect of existence, because I'm very spiritual and I'm on my own spiritual path. Now, Patrick, you have a huge gay following, and I know that you've been deemed and quoted as being pretty gay-friendly. You know, you're pretty content within your own sexuality, and I know that there are a lot of hatred being spewed, you know, as far as gay people are concerned, and they're talking about the whole gay agenda. So at what point in your life did you decide for yourself that people were people no matter who they were, and why are you so free in embracing gay people?
Because the greatest superhero ever on the planet that we have ever researched was Jesus Christ. And Jesus Christ was helping the lepers, helping the prostitutes, and he was helping anybody. Jesus Christ was teaching that you must love everybody as your neighbor. Everybody is your neighbor. Now, obviously, if someone tries to harm me or harm my wife and child, then, you know, they're barking up the wrong tree with me because, you know, I am capable of killing a man within 2 seconds. Not that I want
to. All right.
It's just that
all right,
it's like I'm very capable of that just with my bare hands. It's just that when you have great power, your job is to use it with responsibility. Now, if I see, you know, as I got older, I mean, when I was young, I was being taught to feign hatred. In my local community, I remember being told, you know, don't ever go around any gay people. They're the bogeymen, and that they will bugger you. They will go up your butthole. That's what was even being told to me by my own father, you know, and just be careful of them. Yeah, so I was like, oh, wow. You know, as a little kid, so you're immediately thinking, if they're the bogeyman, we got to watch out. So you're being programmed for hate by your local environment. And I remember this incident where my other straight friends that we were hanging out, and there was this, you know, it was an obvious gay boy, and he was rather feminine, and he looked rather lost in our neighborhood. And he kind of said hi with a flair to him that we took a disdain to, like, you know, he's a gay boy. He's a fairy. And so at eight years old, we started chasing him and kind of bullying him and picking on him. And then another kid picked up a stone and threw it at him. And I remember going, yeah, let's do that. And I picked up the stone and I was getting ready to throw it at him. And I don't know if my stone got him or someone's stone got him, but I saw him get hurt. He hit him in the back and he went, ow. And I dropped my stone. I think I just felt so...
It's all right, man. It's okay. It's all right, brother.
I'm sorry.
It's all right. That's okay, man. I'm getting it.
Let me just take a moment. I felt his pain. I felt his pain, man, because I had been through pain. I had been bullied by my mother. I had been bullied by people. And here I was becoming a bully. And so I was like, that's never going to happen again.
Blessed be.
And I said, at this moment forward, I'm not going to be a part of this bullying towards gay people. And I found that boy and I apologized to him. And ever since then, I've just said, you know what? I don't understand why gay men are attracted to gay men. I don't. I mean, I can admire a beautiful man. I can see his physique is great. I can admire the heart of a great man. I could admire the beauty of another man. I have no problem with that because my sexuality is very geared towards women, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm currently practicing absolute sacredness with my wife.
Right.
But
right.
That's not the issue that Jesus would talk about. The issue is there. You're human. A gay person is a human being. It's a day, you know. Like whatever a gay person's path is and journey is, that's between them and God. You know what
that's
they're
right.
doing in their bedroom. What they're doing in their bedroom is between them and God. It's not my business. You know, it's not my business to judge that. And ultimately,
right.
I have learned to be at peace with being a massage therapist. I'm at peace with a gay person touching my body if they're doing it in a respectful fashion,
right.
In an admiring fashion, in a kind fashion. I've danced at many gay clubs, and if a gay person touches me like I'm a piece of meat or tries to degrade me, I could grab their hand and look at them and say that I'm not that one. You know,
right.
I'm not the one
right.
for you to degrade. I don't know what you've been through that you want to degrade me, because I've been championing you guys ever since I put my stone down at 8. So
yes,
I expect you as a gay community, should be supporting me, because I'm the straight guy that has taken all of the firing stones from Hollywood for supporting you guys. You know,
right.
And sometimes I do get a little bit upset that, you know, for instance, I had a conversation with Tyler Perry, and he had me up at his house in Hollywood. I sat and talked with him, and my agent was right there, and he was getting ready to put me in a movie. I think it was called I Can Do Bad by Myself with Taraji. And he said, look, you're a great actor. I really want you in there. You belong at the top of Hollywood, man. Remember, he put his hand, like, you're up here, man. He complimented me. He said, but I'm just having problems with the fact that you dance for gay people. You know, and I was like, well, why would you have a problem with that? It's like, well, it's on YouTube, and some of my church members, audience will have a problem with it. I'm like, well, maybe we need to wake them up and realize that they shouldn't have a problem with it, you know? I don't understand why should they have a problem with it? Why is all this hypocrisy going on? I mean, I don't understand. You're Madea, you know? Why are they going to have a problem with me being masculine and saying, well, I'm not going to hate on gay people. Why are they going to have a problem with me when you're playing Madea in a dress and makeup? I don't quite understand it. But he told me he had an issue with it, and he never cast me for the role. And so every time he was like, he wanted to put me in a role, he was like scratching his head. And I could see the man. He said, you know what, Marcus, maybe you're stronger than I at this situation. I said, well, maybe I am, but I'm just going to continue being me for God. I said, Tyler, you know what it's like to live for God. I said, you told me you were homeless and you were writing scripts homeless, you know. I said, you know how many times I've had to turn down big money just because I can't sell out God? I can't sell out truth. To sell out gay people at that moment, to me, would have been selling out God. Why? Because I'm not here to judge gay people. I'm here to just be Marcus and be kind to everybody. Now, if God ever wants to judge gay people, that's between God and gay people, not me.
Right, right.
You know what I mean? That's not my job.
Well, I want to thank you for being so candid about that. I really honestly have an even more profound love for you, because that's pretty much what you've always generated for me and what I've always saw in you. So you are, and I want to say congratulations on your wife and your beautiful new son. So because of all that you've gone through, have you thought about how you are going to cultivate this beautiful new spirit that you've been blessed with? What is his name, by the way?
Well, we've got another one on the way. We've got Ethan Adonai, Patrick Marcus Osborne, who is our first son together. And we wanted to give him a name which took the Lord in it. So Ethan means immortal. Adonai means Lord. And then Patrick Marcus Osborne, which is my birth name, noble warrior, realized that my name meant noble warrior of God at the ripe age of about 30. And it started to make sense. Like, well, why am I such a difficult person for these Hollywood studios to deal with? Because they want me to always do something that doesn't go in correlation to being a really good, loving person at times, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it made sense to me as to why maybe I wouldn't do the things that they think I should be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
people are sometimes confused, like, Marcus, why do you sell out and dance in the club for gay people if you won't sell out Hollywood? I'm like, well, in a club with gay people, here's the blessing of a club for gay people.
Mm-hmm.
A pink elephant could walk in the door with a tutu or a spandex dress, and everybody would just go, hey, how you doing? You're welcome.
All right.
Because in the gay club, no one is they've been so persecuted by society that no one's going to really, you know, persecute anybody in there. It's like most people who are straight and ignorant are so unaware of how diverse the gay community is. You got conservative gays, you got download gays, you got undercover gays, you got masculine gays, you got leather gays, you got like femme gays, you got transsexuals, bisexuals,
right.
I mean, it's like you can't just say, oh, that person is gay and that's the way they are, because it's like it's as diverse as any other culture. There's a world within a world of them. And you've got majority of the boys dancing in there straight. I'd say 80 to 90% of the dancers are straight, because for some reason gay people champion straight, young, buff boys.
Right.
And if you look at the Greek culture back in the day, it wasn't so demonizing of gay culture. It was like, look, let's find a purpose for the gay men, because the gay men used to champion the straight athlete. They would help him to train. They would massage him. They would polish him, scrub his skin. And he was their straight athlete, and they worshipped him in a sort of loving way. And obviously, there was not – the sort of sexual exchange. It was just like he was their straight athlete. They championed him. And the Olympics was nude. The original Olympics in Greek was nude. All these demigods, Achilles and Hercules and these people that you would, Perseus, they were nude. They were throwing these discs nude. That's why you see all these wonderful Greek statues. And that's why I've been obsessed with that culture, because it was mind, body, and spirit, and naked in the sun and getting tanned. And most people are unaware that if you really look at what Socrates looked like in the Greek Museum in Greece, he looked like a black man. He's got kind of curly hair. He's got a wide African kind of nose with thick lips, you know. The whole culture of what they look like, especially with what I found to be highly offensive, was this recent movie by Ridley Scott, which was the movie Exodus. It was like, to me, I'm like, you put in Christian Bale as a role, and then your excuses that you can't get A-list black actors to justify your budget, you know, that's garbage.
You got to freak, man. You could have picked any
of the bigger actors. You got Denzel if you wanted to have represented it better. You've got Will Smith. You've got The Rock if you really wanted to go that route, you know. So my point is, the whole society has actually been hoodwinked. And the problem is with all this hoodwinking is that it's what creates this anger and this hate. Because what's being done to the black community is, if you systematically break a black community down and make them not believe that they are kings and queens, now they're just being taught, look, you a nigger, we're going to shoot you, and this is that. This is how your society is, this is your role in society. And now, you know, they're upset, they're angry, and they're angry at everything. Therefore, justifiably so, they will want to strike back at the police, you know, and to some degree, what's more unfortunate, striking back at each other. And I don't think like this because I'm saying it in a racist. I'm part of it. I'm black in my mind. You know, you might think I'm light-skinned. I'm like, no, it doesn't matter. I'm light-skinned. My mother told me, look, you ain't white, boy. You got a black mother. I've endured just as much racism as any dark-skinned black guy. As a matter of fact, I probably endured more, because the white people were racist to me, and sometimes the black people were racist to me. So I had to find God, because I had no one to look up or look at. And all my heroes that I grew up looking at, come to find out, you know, they're all on steroids all the time, or coke, whether it's, you know, they're all getting busted for steroids, whether it was the wrestlers or the Schwarzeneggers, the Stallones, the Van Dams. It was like, you know, I still love and revere the work that they put in to help inspire me as a youth, but you grow up going, oh, it's really not the truth. It's really not the truth, you know? So the point is, when I found this brother, Nun Amen Ra, which everyone should be, like, tuning into and respecting his time and paying him $100 an hour just to, like, have a conversation with him on Skype, I'm like, look, if y'all want to wake up, you need to find the original Bible, and you need to find the guy that knows how to translate it. And don't look at this as an attack against your current beliefs. Look at it as the upgrade of your current belief. Your current belief has been perversed through many generations. You got to think about how many translations this original scripture took. And most people who are ready to say, oh, you're being blasphemous here, Marcus, because you've got to just follow the Christian way and blah, blah, blah. Like, well, have you been to Jerusalem and put your hands in Jerusalem yourself? Have you been to all quarters of it, the Catholic section, the Christian section, the Judaic section, and the Muslim Dome of the Rock? Have you floated in the Dead Sea? Have you taken the journey that Jesus would have took to Egypt and gone to Egypt and gone in the pyramid? No, you haven't. Mm-hmm. I have. Then I go to Greece and check that whole thing out. When you see these things, you're like, okay, these Bible stories must have been real. There were giants on the earth back then. Well, it's all been hidden, you know? So when you put us all together, what I have to say is that
I tell you, you're going to have to come back on this show again, and I'm going to have to, like, hone up on my understanding of the message and the word, and you most certainly have given me a jump start this afternoon. You've just been an incredible guest on the show. I thank you for your honesty and admire you for your candidness when you spoke of certain things, you know, and your fearlessness. So we're reaching the end of the show, and I just have a question. Is there something specific that fans can do to help support any causes that you're currently working on? Is there anything that you need from us, Marcus?
I would just say love each other. You know, you can be nice to me if you feel that that's something that's in your heart to help me out. I mean, I've got campaigns. I'm starting a sanctuary in Hawaii, which is designed to help teach people the true information and upgrade them, mind, body, and spirit. You know, I would love to be able to employ Nunaiman Ra as the head teacher research scientist over there. You know, I've started a GoFundMe campaign that my wife helped get started. I would love to be able to obviously set up a sanctuary where it taught, you know, people to upgrade. That would be wonderful. If there are people who have got more money than they know what to do with and they want to donate to a sanctuary where it's about healing people's minds, bodies, and spirits, that's one thing I would love. But if that doesn't happen, I would just say, you know, learn to love each other and learn to get back to the heart message of what Christ was talking about. Because it doesn't really, you know, whether you believe Christ to be real, fiction, myth, legend, or just a story like a fable like Superman, it really doesn't matter. Christ said, love each other and do good and learn to drink your water. Because if you drink water all day and you do it right, and Nunaiman Ra is the authoritarian on how to drink the water right, because he's got the original code as to how to drink the waters correctly and when to eat and when to fast, definitely look up Nunaiman Ra. The thing is that will literally transform a body that's full of pollutants, toxins, poisons, anger, hatred, sickness, and disease into a nice, calm, serene lake of clean, drinkable water. Most human beings' bodies have accumulated so much toxicity unbeknowingly over the course of their lifetime that all of the emotions and energy and anger and sickness and diseases that are racking their body is coming from their body being like an internal swamp. A swamp is going on, a stagnant lake, a stagnant pond. And in order to get that crap out, you've got to start drinking and peeing, drinking and peeing, drinking and peeing, and cutting down or out on sugars and not just gorging oneself gluttonly. You know, you really do have to look at thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not be gluttonous, thou shalt not covet another man's wife. Thou shalt not. Those Ten Commandments that came originally from Moses probably came from the Egyptian ideology as to how to create a functional society where everybody cares about each other and loves each other, and you've got a collective going on. The problem is...
The word for the close of the show is just going to be love one another and drink plenty of water. And Marcus, I want to thank you for being a wonderful guest on the show. Whenever you are ready to come back, and I certainly will just keep following behind your wisdom because I'm learning as I go along as well. You're welcome here at any time. I just want to say thank you so much for being a guest on the show.
Thank you for having me.
All right, my brother. You have a wonderful evening. God bless you, and congratulations on the new family. My man, you deserve that. Do you hear me? You deserve everything that's coming your way. All right, my brother. You take care of
yourself. Hey, let me leave with one prayer, please. May you and anybody who's listening be blessed by the Lord of this universe, the Lord of love, light, truth, health, wealth, true prosperity, true prosperity. Doesn't mean money. It just means prosperity in your heart. And gratitude. May you be blessed and guided. Be guided by the Lord of the universe. Electromagnetic frequency will come into your heart and your mind and teach you things that you have no idea existed. Be guided and be open to the Lord of that.
Amen. Amen. Thank you. Thank you for blessing this show. Thank you for blessing this life. You have a wonderful evening, my friend.
Thank you. God bless. Bye-bye.
God bless. Bye-bye. Okay, you guys, I just need a moment right now. Oh, I got tears in my eyes. I was wondering, you know, I guess the nerves that I had in me was wondering how I would take that energy from such a remarkable human being. Marcus Patrick, I have to tell you right now, this is one of the best shows that I've ever did here on Under Touch of Grace, and it has profoundly impacted my life. I want to thank you guys for tuning in this afternoon. What a remarkable human being. I just love that guy so much. Here's some information about some upcoming shows. On Monday, May 18th, 2015, at 2 p.m. Pacific Time, let me try this again because Marcus has just got me right now, 2 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the 18th, which is Monday, actor Troy Bland from ATL will join me to discuss his exciting life in front of the camera and on theater stages. His charismatic charm and talent landed him a role in the upcoming biopic film, Bessie, based on the life of Bessie Smith, starring Queen Latifah. Then on Tuesday, May 19th, at 2 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, C. Sharp Mokeki, I hope I pronounced that right, singer-performer from the motherland, South Africa, joins GD's A Touch of Grace to discuss his incredible life on performance stages around the globe. This will be my second international show, so I'm pretty excited. Special thanks go out to my friends at World Media for being of great support to the show, and special shout out to my friend and colleague, Louis Randy Rand Wilkerson. He's in love, and I'm so happy for this brother. He's the inspiring man behind Coffee with God by Randy Rand, who put his money where his mouth was last year. Brother, I love you very much. Congratulations. I'm so happy for you. And this is a final word. God, Marcus is still, his energy is still going through me. As a result of the mistakes we've made, our wisdom has grown. We are wiser from what we have endured, and we walk in the profound cue of confidence we have earned. No one can diminish or belittle this power we carry within us, because it is stronger than the deep roots of the ancient oak that withstands the test of time. Live, learn, and prosper. Thank you for tuning in today. You have a nice week. Take care. This is GD signing off.